Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Hey!
Here's John Williams.
What a nice day. Doesn't count, does it? It's 108. This is John. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. We're here until 3, and then Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 12 noon. We have a lot of fun on Saturdays, too. On all social media, I'm WGN King John. I'm not king yet in real life. I want to be. The paperwork, I'm told, is tied up at Cook County. Yes, there's still paperwork and analog over there, but once it goes through and I get to be king, things will be running more smoothly. And I won't be pardoning myself neither. You know, as much as you hate to hear the very conversation about should the president pardon himself or could the president pardon himself, I mean, that shouldn't even be a conversation. The only reason you have that conversation is because maybe the president has done something either illegal or impeachable or both, and then the issue of him pardoning himself comes into play. You'd like to think that the president of the United States wouldn't even be eligible for that conversation, but there we are. And if I'm Rudy Giuliani, and that's something you don't normally begin to say, but if I were, I would say, when asked about the notion that the president could or might, I would say we're not even going to address that. That is one question that you do not have to entertain. You don't have to do anything. And that is such a dispiriting conversation that I think if I were them, you know, I would say we'll cross that bridge if we ever get there. We have no expectation we'll be there. Next question, please. But if you found yourself in a position where you were either convicted of a crime, well, I guess, say, convicted of a crime, and you could impeach yourself, and you felt that you were wrongly convicted, well, then you would pardon yourself, wouldn't you? I wonder how many of us, you know, on principle, would say, no, I won't use the pardon power. I will go to jail now. I'll bet you wouldn't. I'll bet you wouldn't. If they said, hey, did you rob that bank? And you say, no, I didn't. Even if you did, you think, heck, I don't have to go to jail. I promise I won't rob any more banks. You would probably pardon yourself. If you obstructed justice, whatever that means, and you don't think you did, and they convicted you of it, and they impeached you of it, or one or the other, or both, would you pardon yourself? I'm just going to guess you probably would. I think my thought on this is fairly consistent. For instance, I said when it was discovered that maybe the Russians had a meeting with Donald Trump Jr. and they wanted to talk about adoption and Don Jr. wanted some information about the Hillary campaign. So they take the meeting and then the thing blows up and we all know the rest of that story, at least to where it is today. But do you think that if the Clinton campaign was told, hey, we've got damaging information about your opponent from the Russians, do you think they would take that meeting? Me, I think they would. I think you might too. Didn't work out so well for the Trump team. That's where we are today. But back to the pardoning yourself. Would you pardon yourself? I think you probably would. Violetta, if you were convicted of a crime and you could get out of jail, would you get yourself out of jail?
Yes.
If you're playing Monopoly and you have the get out of jail free card, you have the get out of jail free card. Do you play that? Do you use it?
Well, that's the thing. You got to use it at the right time if you did more than one thing wrong.
Yeah. I would say, okay, just wait until I'm going to use it, but I'm not going to right now. I just want to make sure all these
let it all pile on.
Because the power of the pardon comes to you as president. Once you're not president, then you don't have the power of the pardon. So if you're convicted of crimes after the fact, or if those convictions come after the fact, then you sort of lost that right. So timing is probably critical there. In fact, it might be the sort of situation where you'd say, hey, listen, yeah, I did get convicted of that crime. And as it turns out, I robbed a bank, too. Let's go ahead and get that one through the system real quick because I'm still president and I can pardon myself. We'll talk a little bit more about the latest on this story in the next hour. Speaking of the White House, and we're not going to dwell on that today. It's a lovely day. But I'm kind of curious about whether or not we'll find out from the people that were at this Gold Star Families meeting this evening. There's a celebration or an event honoring Gold Star Families this evening, and the First Lady is supposed to appear. We haven't seen her for going on a month now. This makes her absence, according to Vanity Fair, the longest first lady absence in modern presidential history, whatever that means. But usually you had an appearance from one of the Bush wives or from Michelle Obama or Mrs. Reagan, et cetera, et cetera. They'd pop up here and again.
Well, it's not even just formal outings. She hasn't been seen anywhere.
She didn't go on the family vacation. That is, they all went to Camp David this weekend. It's very funny to watch the Trumps trundle off to Camp David. Camp David, to me, sounds like a place where you do some canoeing and hiking and fishing. I'm sure it's a swell place. But it's a camp. It's Camp David. I would imagine you'd be wearing some Dockers and a T-shirt, maybe your cargo shorts. When the Trumps walk to the helicopter, they look like they're going to a, I don't know, GQ photo shoot. They all look spectacular. Great shoes, matching skirts and jackets and ties.
Maybe they canoe in their suits.
And I explain it this way, that these are their work and school and professional clothes. These are their public clothes as the first family. So I'm sure they'll change out of those suits and ties when they get there. But to see them going off on vacation, doesn't look like a lot of fun. And of course, Melania didn't go. And I didn't see Barron in the picture. And I suppose she decided to stay back with her son. Maybe that's easier for the family. Maybe that's easier for him. Who knows? But I have three theories about Melania's absence, and I just wonder which of these do you think is true? A, she's recovering from cosmetic surgery. B, she's done with her husband. She's done with being the first lady, and she's just checked out. She's just like, nah, I'm not going to do it anymore. I'm not going to be seen with you, and I'm not going to be doing this anymore. Be best, be schmest. See ya. She's done with it. And C, she's actually fine. She's A-okay. She's quietly recovering from that surgery. She's not flying to places like Singapore or Quebec because she doesn't want to. Sometimes after surgery, you don't want your blood to clot in a depressurized cabin, so you don't fly. And there's no grand scheme. There's no more of an explanation to it other than she doesn't have to be seen publicly and she doesn't want to be seen publicly right now.
Remember, though, the White House is saying it wasn't surgery. It was a procedure.
Okay, so it's A, B, or C. It's A, she's recovering from a cosmetic procedure. B, she's just done. I mean, one thing that gets lost in the discussions about the president and the investigation in the Congress these days is that the First Lady has been having to sort of tolerate the public humiliation, the ongoing conversation and public humiliation of her husband paying hush money to an adult film star. That's there every day. And I don't know how you get around that. I don't know if they've had time for therapy or counseling, but to me, that would be a really big injury. And so I can completely understand her wanting to just shrink away from it all. That would be B. C, she's fine. She's not the president. She didn't have to make a public appearance for you. And they say that she's stubborn, right? She's a little bashful, but she's also stubborn. And I can just see somebody like her, you or me, saying, you know what? I'm not going to make a public appearance because, in fact, you want me to make a public appearance. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. Not for you. Are you kidding me? No, I'm not going to do that. And so then the disappearance becomes a thing unto itself.
Can we add another question onto this?
Those are the only three possible options I can imagine.
But the tweet, did the tweet come from her based on those three options?
100% no way. Which, I don't know, which maybe adds a layer of intrigue to all of this, but I mean, it doesn't sound like
it.
Her.
It sounds exactly like President Trump.
Well, that's what it is. Here's the tweet, and this came on May 30th. I see the media is working overtime, speculating where I am and what I'm doing. Rest assured, I'm here at the At White House with my family, feeling great and working hard on behalf of children and the American people! Exclamation point. Yeah, she wrote that. Uh-huh. Yeah, right.
She doesn't care about the media working overtime.
Yeah, she's not. And I do believe the First Lady does have a responsibility to the country. It's your team, and you may not like it, but there's an obligation there. And I think it does come with a lot of work. I have no idea how you fill out your day. Like if you're planning the 4th of July picnic, that the White House will have. They say she's involved in that. I don't know if that's a lot of meetings where people are poring over notes going, bratwurst, Polish, I don't know. Come on, let's make a decision here.
We need Melania for this.
Get in here, Melania. Polish brats, do we go with the footlongs? Sesame seeds on the buns? What do we do? What do we do?
I feel like they plan.
Nobody's leaving this room until we get that nailed down.
Sorry. I feel like they probably plan it all and she just, okay.
Rubber stamps it, yeah.
Okay.
Or here's some
okay.
menu options. Do you like the coleslaw or do we go with the potato salad? And then she says, well, let me taste them and then we'll go. It's probably like that. I'm sure that she has to approve things. And maybe they ask her, what's your vision? Well, I want children and I want, you know, this and that. And so then they make it happen. But is that work? So, for instance, her husband seems to be able to find the spotlight. So are the responsibilities of the First Lady so demanding that she actually can't be seen publicly because she's pounding away behind closed doors?
But this whole relationship with the public and the First Lady started off the presidency with her potentially living in New York.
Yeah, right.
So, I mean, she's come a long way at really filling the role of First Lady.
Well, it can be a combination of the three. Recovering from cosmetic surgery, done with her husband and the office, or she's fine. It's none of this. She's busy toiling away and just doesn't want to make a public appearance. Now, it could be that, plus she had cosmetic surgery. Or it could be that she's busy toiling away for the American people and she's done with her husband. It could be B and C. It could be all three. King John says, this texter from 708, it's all of the above. From 847, I vote for C. She's busy toiling away for the American people. From 815, plastic surgery? Sure, why not? From 312, I mean, does she need it? Not by me, but I don't know. I don't know. I mean, that's the sort of thing that people sometimes shrink away from public life. They want to wait until their face or whatever recovers. John, I think after 2 years, it's time to put your cards on the table and end it. That's somebody speaking on behalf of Melania with her husband. 630, John, is impeachment a pardonable offense? Okay, 312-981-7200. That's the number you're texting to. That's the number you can call. Melania is going to make an appearance this evening, but the press has not been invited. So I wonder if the people that are there, the families and some representatives from whatever organizations, surely they'll be asked, how did she look? What was it like? And we'll get maybe some sort of anecdotal reporting back. One last note about Melania's disappearance of late. Rex Hupke's piece was pretty funny on this topic. I don't know if you read it, but in part he said, America's First Lady last seen in public May 10th. On Friday morning, we learned she will not join the president this weekend. He wrote it Thursday at Camp David. Her absence has sparked all manner of wild theorizing, from rumors of plastic surgery to suggestions that she moved back to New York City. After minutes of careful conjuring and professional assumptionizing, I unraveled the truth. The deep state helped sneak Melania out of the White House through a tunnel, and she is now living with Barack and Michelle Obama. The timeline of events goes like this. April 21st. Melania attends the funeral of former First Lady Barbara Bush and is photographed sitting next to Barack and Michelle Obama. Suspiciously, Melania is smiling warmly for the first time in recorded history. May 7th, Melania introduces her anti-bullying campaign, Be Best. It's a clear shot at her husband, who invented bullying and prides himself on being worst. May 10th, the First Lady is last seen in public. May 14th, Melania has kidney surgery. Few details are given. May 19th, the White House reports that the First Lady has returned to the White House, though there's no explanation for a five-day hospital stay following a surgery many doctors said is an outpatient procedure. May 20th, a sinkhole is spotted on the north lawn of the White House. This is true. Did you see the story? They had a sinkhole in the White House front lawn. 10 days later, May 30th, as questions mount about the First Lady's whereabouts, a tweet is sent from her Twitter account that reads, I see the media is working overtime, speculating where I am and what I'm doing. Rest assured, I'm here at the White House with the family feeling great on behalf of the American people. And then he writes later in his column, Rex Hupke does, we all know Eric Trump is a vampire. You can Google it. And as such, he must have an underground lair at the White House. That makes him the only person connected to the administration with the subterranean skills to create an escape tunnel. The sinkhole was just a minor tunnel cave-in that happened weeks after Melania fled. And there you have it, Melania Gate. She's fled via tunnel that Eric created to be with the Obamas. I'm glad we could clear that up for you. It's 1:27. Speaking of presidential news, I thought that Bill Clinton's interview on the Today Show today was astounding. I was amazed, one, that he would write a work of fiction with a fiction writer. They co-authored it. Bill Clinton's expertise in, was it James Patterson that wrote the book? So then this thriller writer, and the two of them got together and wrote a book about a president. Okay, that's one. Then two, that Clinton goes, yes, it was Patterson. Then two, that Clinton goes out on a book tour, right? So I guess when you do a book tour, you sit down with schlubs like me or the Today Show, and they ask you about the book. And they ask you whatever the heck else they want to ask you. So now you're kind of open. And in light of the hashtag MeToo movement, Bill Clinton is in kind of a precarious position. He wants to promote his book. I'm not exactly sure why he wants to be promoting it. It'll probably sell either way. But there he is sitting down to book tour interviews. But then B, in light of all that's happened in the last, I don't know, pick it, 6 months, year, you know questions are going to come up about you and you know who, and they did. And the way he handled it was, I think, spectacularly bad. We'll get to that after the news. It's 1:28 and the news is next. I'm interested in a tweet that I saw today by one Jamal. Do you go by something other than Jamal Cole on Twitter and social media?
Everything is just for my block. F-O-R, my block. Everything I do is for my block. Democracy starts at the block level. What's something simple you can do for your block? So for my block at everything.
We discovered you, a lot of us did, when you organized a snow shoveling campaign. What happened?
I live in Chatham on the south side of Chicago, and Chatham's a state of mind that represents community organizing, and 70% of the 70% of the population of Chatham is seniors, and they got overwhelmed because of the snowstorm. You know, a lot of them had neuropathy in their wrists, they were on oxygen tanks, or they had walkers, so some of them had doctor's appointments. I needed help, so I just tweeted out to Chicago, hey, I need 10 people to meet me on 79th Street, Red Line Station. I got shovels, I got hoodies, I have some hot chocolate, come through. And I woke up the next day with 60,000 tweets, and there was 130 people on my block.
And it was people not just from the neighborhood, but people from the suburbs. It was white people, black people. It was tall people. It was small people.
It was people from far away as Indiana came.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, man. Chicago's a great city. We got people of all different colors, genders, religions, ethnicities, occupations, and all that good stuff. But, you know, we're all Chicagoans, and we all got to organize together. So
quote your tweet about the city being dirty.
So the city's real dirty, and we know why. It's because we haven't cleaned it. Da-da-da-da. So clean up the city for the people and me, and we'll be happy. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. The city's real dirty, and we know why. Because we haven't cleaned it up, and that ain't no lie. If you clean your blah, 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 blah. It was an old lady from 8400 Block Club. And she.
I wondered, was that her originally or was that you?
That was her, man. That was all
her. That was her thing. She posted that and then you retweeted it?
Oh, no. I was talking to her in the morning. We were at Dunkin' Donuts on 87th and King. And we were talking about people littering in Cole Park. And I was asking her, what can I do to help, you know, organize a cleanup for you? And she just started, she said that song.
That was her? That was her originally? Because as a rapper, you're pretty bad. I'm thinking, dude, you do not have a career in hip-hop, rap, or any of that thing.
I'm the real J. Cole. That's where I thought the first J. Cole.
So then you post that, and I'm thinking, my wife and I were walking along the lake up by Wrigley Field.
Okay.
And Montrose Harbor. It's lovely if you're willing to look past the garbage, which is just strewn about. And I'm like, what the hell's happened to people? This isn't the 1960s. It's not cool to litter.
Man, and we need to do something about it. What's an innovative way to get people to stop littering? I've seen things where overseas they put like the free throw line in front of the litter baskets to get people to make a game out of it. I was like, we got to do that in Cole Park just to get people, since they're locking the rims anyway, let's put the free throw line around the garbage trash.
Well, do you think that there's enough trash receptacles?
No.
Maybe that's giving people a pass, but I think the people that dropped their liter bottles and their picnic garbage, if there was a thing closer, maybe they would have dropped it in there?
No, it's a state of mind, man. No, I mean, I've seen people just take their church's chicken and just dump the box on the ground or just like it's nothing. It's like anything is a habit. Like if you look around and you see decay, if you have to order your food through bulletproof glass windows, if helicopters are flying over your house, you start to feel like nobody cares. So why should you care? But if you live in a community where you see people picking up their trash, where you see people saying hello to the neighbor, it fosters more inclusivity, and that's a learned behavior. So
I talked to somebody about this phenomenon last week, and she said there was a study done, and what they did was they put flyers on people's windshields, and then, you know, when you come out and you say, oh, what's this, and it's an advertisement under my windshield wiper blade, and you might be inclined to throw it on the ground. And sometimes people would, but then sometimes the researchers, when the person was coming out of the store to their car, they would have somebody with that flyer wad it up in their hand so that the person could see and then place it in the garbage. And it happens in your brain. If you see somebody throw the flyer away, all of those people threw it away. But if it's just on the ground, people are inclined to put it on the ground.
Yeah, it's because when you... It's like taking the cart back to the...
Exactly.
It's just like taking it back to the corral. It's like, that's a habit you have to build. So if you throw some litter on the ground, you say, oh, this is not going to turn my block into a landfill. It's not making a big impact on your block, but it's making a big impact on your habits. And when your habits start going bad, that's when things start happening. So like I tell people, like, it's just as easy it is to pick something up off the ground. It's just that easy not to do it. So it's just that easy not to litter.
But Jamal, in the Lakeview neighborhood where I live, you don't order your fast food through bulletproof glass. Maybe they do on the south side. It does, so there's no explanation where I live. But you're describing a sad neighborhood where people are dispirited. And so it's like, what the hell? Who cares if I throw the garbage on the ground? We got helicopters flying overhead.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's what happens. If you've been looking at boarded up windows, you're going to make a split decision and say, I don't want to send my kid to school next to a methadone clinic. I mean, anybody's going to say that. But that people are desensitized to the gunshots. People are desensitized to the sirens, but we haven't given up hope. There's not a deficit of hope. People like me live in Chatham, and I live to rekindle that spirit of community organizations.
And this is such a small thing. You know, it's funny. Maybe in a way, while it's not the most important thing, it maybe is the best place to start, because you can't fix gun violence, but you can pick up the trash. Maybe it starts there.
Yeah, what's something simple you can do that'll have a positive impact on your block? Just because it's simple don't mean it's easy, but you're right. You got to start somewhere. They say to move a mountain, you got to start with the pebbles, right? So let's clean the block up first. That's how I feel about it.
Your T-shirt says, my block, my hood, my city. So is that a South or West Side initiative?
No, it's like to truly make our city better, we need more people, young and old, to visit community areas outside their own. When something negative happens on a South Side community, especially where people look a lot different than other people, it might as well happen in another country. But when you visit different communities and you interact with the residents, it could change all that. So it's all about interconnectivity and One Chicago.
But you know, when you did that snow shoveling thing and people came from all around, I think people have it in their heart to help. They would like to be included. They want somebody to show them the way. But I think they're intimidated to go to 79th and the Red Line.
I'm intimidated to go to Lakeview. I mean, I don't think Abraham Lincoln could afford to live in Lincoln Park. But I'm just saying, like, at the end of the day, it's like, you know, try driving, being black. I mean, you get pulled over once a month just for, you know, having dark skin. So
I get that point. But if you're reaching out to all the communities out there, I think it helps if there's somebody like you who will hold our hand, that will say, hey, I'll meet you there. We're going to be okay, and we're going to pick up the trash together.
Yeah, I mean, you got to step outside your comfort zone, and that expands your worldview. And we connect not because of our color, but by our values. And I think that's what resonated with people that day on 79th.
Tell me a little bit more about your organization, and tell me specifically how folks might start doing what you're talking about in just a minute. We'll pause here. Okay. You remember this guy? Jamal Cole's in our city, and he's on our show. This is WGN. Jamal Cole, the very bad rapper, is in our studio. What do you call yourself, a community organizer?
I'd call myself Jamal.
What do you do for a living?
I help people.
So your organization is For My Block, formyblock.org. is the website, formyblock.org.
Yes, sir.
So if you want to get involved, if you want to participate, if you want to make a donation, that's the place to go.
Yeah, man, a lot of kids in Chicago have never left their block. They've never been downtown.
Yeah, you guys do academic tours, right, for kids? Yeah,
exactly. We call them explorations, but we expose them to different professions, different careers, different cuisines. In Chicago, we think we're so different, man. If you go to Pilsen, you're going to have, you know, a tortilla, beef, and rice. If you go to, you know, Devon Avenue, you're going to have naan, beef, and rice. You go to Greektown, you're going to have pita, beef and rice. Like we think we're so different. We're really the same. So I just get kids to step outside their comfort zone and explore different parts of Chicago.
But that takes money. You got to rent a bus and you got to get chaperones and you got to get da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yes, sir. So we actually are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and you can go to formyblock.org and you can get a t-shirt or a hoodie. 100% of the proceeds go directly towards our Explorers.
That's what
program.
We got to do. Look, if you don't want to pick up the trash, if this isn't convenient or comfortable for you, if you, well, that's all great. What am I going to do? Go buy the damn t-shirt. You know, you can wax your car with it if you want. Buy 100 of the t-shirts, or buy one t-shirt and donate the 99 to somebody else, or just make a cash donation.
You're awesome. That's, we could use it and Chicago could use it. So thank you guys for the support.
Your tweet today, which was quoting, or actually it was the video of a woman, that woman you met at the donut shop?
Yep, Miss Sam. She's on 84th. And King.
And so she's tweeting and singing about how, you know, look, this trash, we've got a dirty city, we got to clean it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that now that summer's finally here, and we're all enjoying the good weather, and it's like, hey, let's go to the lake and look at the beautiful skyline. But I'm telling you, when you look at your feet, there's just way too much garbage in this beautiful city on the ground.
It's a beautiful city. What's something simple you can do that'll change everything?
So what do you want people to do, though, Donald? But they say, okay, I live on X block. I want to get the t-shirts, get some bags, and organize it. And that's kind of what you do?
That's what we do. We have a group of over 4,000 volunteers in the city. If you want to get involved on the block level and do some grassroots cleanup, go to formyblock.org and sign up, and we will definitely contact you.
Okay. Anything else I can do for you, Jamal?
You've been helpful, man. I love your spirit, and I want to learn how not to be defensive from you, because you seem to be, you know everything about interviewing people, so.
You're not defensive. Do you think I sounded a little defensive before you came on?
No, I just thought you analyzed the Bill Clinton interview perfectly, and you said that he got defensive, so I'm thinking, wow, if you know that, you might know how somebody cannot be defensive.
Trust me, I'm learning from you today. And formyblock.org is the website, formyblock.org. Jamal, stay in touch. Last time we talked, we were going to make plans for you to bring the kids through the radio station. We haven't done that yet, have we?
No, we haven't. That would be awesome, though.
We're going to get that done.
Okay.
Just dawned on me. Okay, formyblock.org, Jamal Cole. Thanks for visiting. And
thanks for having me.
Keep me posted on what you're doing.
Will do, man. Will do. Thank you.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Yep.
Here's John Williams.
Do it on Sundays, too. It's 208. This is John. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. I'm John Williams.
Lord have mercy.
I want to be king someday, but the paperwork is tied up in Cook County. Listen, on social media, you can find me at WGN King John. On the Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook, WGN King John there. We're pretty busy there. We invite you to always check that out, like us, forward our cool stuff. And also check out The Mincing Rascals. It's a podcast that we produce here at WGN Radio's radio. It drops every Thursday afternoon.
Have we figured out this week's edition?
Well, as we do not have a production studio, we are going to do it in the Showcase studio during the White Sox game on Thursday.
Hmm.
Does that work for you?
I think so.
We don't have talkback in between the studios right now, so Steve, you and I will have to do all of our business on the air here.
Well, I'm not going to do all my business on the air.
You know how you have your favorite t-shirts that you like to wear?
Yes.
And there's some t-shirts that you like so much that you don't wear them that often because you save them for special occasions?
I have like a 20-year-old t-shirt that I bought in Ireland that I don't want to wear.
I'm the same way. One of my favorite t-shirts is a black t-shirt that says The Interview Show. It's Mark Baser's interview show. And he gave one for me when he was celebrating an anniversary of the program. It's a really cool shirt. I've never worn it because I keep thinking, well, I'll wear it then. No, I'm not going to wear it to the beach. I'm not going to wear it jogging. I'm not going to wear it to bed. So I've never worn it. Today I busted out my Mark Baser's t-shirt.
Oh, the microphone on it?
Yes.
I noticed that. I've never noticed a shirt you've worn before. I did notice that one, and I like it.
I'm wearing it underneath a long sleeve shirt of similar colors, black and white and blue. And I was, and then I completely forgot about it. I got dressed today. Just thought, I'm just going to rock by a Baser shirt. It's sitting in my closet. Then I stop into a corner bakery to get a cup of coffee. And who is sitting in the corner but Mark Baser?
Nice.
And by this time, of course, I had forgotten that I had the shirt on. So I say, hey, Mark, how are you? And we're sitting there having a cup of coffee, chat. And then he gingerly reaches up and separates, opens the shirt over I'm wearing, my overshirt, my long sleeve shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, are you stalking me? I said, no, why? Oh, yeah, what do you know? I'm wearing your T-shirt. I love life's little coincidences like that.
So, you know, Scott Stantis designed a Tribune Tower shirt.
Yeah, it's very nice.
It's wonderful. It says Tribune Tower, what is it, 2018. So it's, you know, the year's journalism were in Tribune Tower, and a lot of the reporters bought it and went to a charity. I bought two because I wanted them so much. One right. in a gray.
Yeah.
And one in a light blue with a coffee stain on it.
Nice.
Yeah, second wear. And I've washed it like three times, you know, with the spray and wash and the.
I'm trying to remember now if I have or I didn't order. Did I get one of those?
I'll sell you mine. I'll sell you one of mine. Well, there's a nice
I don't
blue.
Have that, and I also don't have my North Korea Summit medallion yet that I ordered online. So I've got a couple of things I'm still waiting for. 211.
Wait, you mean you bought the T-shirt and it hasn't arrived?
I don't remember.
You didn't buy it because it's. I've had it for weeks.
It would have arrived by now. Yeah.
Do you ever develop an aversion for T-shirts over time? I have a shirt that I loved for like 2 years, and now I will not wear it
anywhere.
You're
mad at it? You don't like it anymore?
It's just the fact that it's a crew neck, and I think I look like a potato in that.
Well, that's an interesting observation, Elif. If the what is the theory now about clothes? If they do not bring you joy, you need to discard them.
Mm-hmm.
Don't roll them up and put them in the back of your closet. You need to get rid of them.
I love throwing out clothes.
It's very liberating.
It was my first concert, though. It kind of it holds a special place.
I know. Well, if it doesn't bring you joy anymore, you got to get rid of it. If it does bring you joy, you keep it. That's your call.
Okay.
My favorite shirts are always the ones that I overwear because then they get so comfortable.
Yeah, right.
Not wear. I'd always overwear them.
Maybe my Mark Baser T-shirt will get there. Listen to this. The president says that he has, and Rudy Giuliani says this too, so it must be true, that the president evidently has the unfettered ability to pardon himself from any crimes that he may have committed or may commit. Remember that you can be impeached without having committed a crime, and you can commit crimes and not be impeached for them. Impeachment is a political process, and then there's the criminal justice department. But the Congress could decide that you get to stay president regardless, or they could impeach you even if you did not commit a crime. But the president has the power to pardon. Lord, we know that because we're all kind of sitting here on pins and needles wondering if he's going to commute the sentence anyway of Rod Blagojevich. But it begs the question about what's the purpose of the pardon anyway, and is the president's interpretation of it correct? Dave Schultz is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Minnesota. He's one of America's foremost experts on constitutional law, and he joins us on WGN. Dave, welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing great. How about you today?
Are you wearing a swell T-shirt?
I actually am, but I was thinking about it as that conversation was going. I think I got a couple of those T-shirts, too, that I really like so much that I never wear them. It's strange, isn't it? It is.
So does the president – tell me what the power of the pardon is.
Okay. The power of the pardon is listed in Article 2 of the Constitution, and it grants the president pretty broad ability to grant pardons and clemencies. And the power goes back to, really, the King of England, you know, back to England. And I think the original idea behind the pardoning power was to say that whether out of mercy or maybe perhaps somebody was wrongfully, you know, convicted of something, that presidents would have this broad ability to say that a person has paid enough debts to society or, again, was wrongly convicted. And I think that's the purpose why we have the pardoning power in there in terms of its purpose, because I think, you know, oftentimes dispensing justice and dispensing mercy, probably not a bad thing to do in our society.
But we have a court system that I thought was charged with that responsibility. It seems to me like anymore, I hear or think about pardons as abuses, not as merciful and well thought out acts.
I think it's a good observation. You're right. And I think, the original idea was to say that, I'll go back to it, for, let's say, wrongful convictions or something like that.
But you have a recourse in the system if you're wrongfully convicted.
No, you're absolutely correct. That's what I'm saying, is that one could make the argument, and some people could make the argument and say that perhaps presidents shouldn't be able to do pardoning anymore. But that was the original idea behind it. Whether or not it is an antiquated idea that's maybe should have never carried over from the days when kings could do whatever they want.
Yeah, right.
And that's a reasonable debate to have here.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, give me an example of an egregious abuse. Was Bill Clinton's last day in office an egregious abuse of the pardon? What stands out in your mind, regardless?
Some could argue that when he issued some pardons on the last day that included several of his friends, I think one of them might have been a donor or something like that.
Uh-huh.
That was pretty high on the list in terms of it. Now, depending on how partisan you want to be, some people will argue that when Gerald Ford in 1974 pardoned Richard Nixon, even though he had not been indicted for a crime, some people argued that was potentially an abuse of a pardoning power.
All right, either way, the president has this right. But can he pardon himself?
I'm going to say that the weight of most legal authority and legal scholars is to say, no, he cannot. Okay. And the reason why I say that is that even though we look at the text of the Constitution, it doesn't say he has the power to pardon himself. It doesn't say he doesn't have the power to pardon himself. We've got a couple of court cases out there over time that suggest broader broad readings of pardoning power. But at the end of the day, many of us would come back to a couple of basic principles. One of them is that nobody should be able to put themselves above the law and say that I don't have to be held accountable in a criminal court if indicted. And if you were to allow the president or any president to indict him or herself, presidents could do that. And then two, as I've given several talks, is to say that presidents are not kings, or for those people who are second-generation Star Trek fans, remember Captain Picard, who used to say, make it so, and whatever he make it so with what he wanted to happen? Presidents are not Captain Picard. We have this complex process called checks and balances and separation of powers, is to prevent one person from being judge, jury, and executioner. So if we take those basic principles of common law, basic principles of ideas that say nobody is above the law, the vast majority of constitutional scholars would say the president cannot pardon himself.
Constitution doesn't forbid it, though. It doesn't say the president has the power of pardon and clemency with the exception of himself. It doesn't specifically say that.
It doesn't specifically say that. You're absolutely correct. But if we were to go back to some of the debates surrounding the writing of the Constitution in 1787, the original debates, there were concerns about the scope of presidential pardoning power, concern that we didn't want presidents to be exactly like kings. And so if we can apply those constitutional principles to the situation here, I would argue, and again, the vast majority, if I were to take 100 constitutional scholars, I would say 90 to 95 of them would easily say president can't pardon himself.
Rudy Giuliani begs to differ today.
Yeah, well, Rudy Giuliani is not a constitutional law expert. And Rudy Giuliani is hired to advocate for the president of the United States.
I get that.
The other thing which I would argue is that Trump is getting dangerously close to what I call a Richard Nixon moment. And what I mean by Richard Nixon moment is when Nixon uttered the phrase, I am not a crook. And in a situation like this now, where if the president's assertion is no longer, I didn't do anything wrong, to, well, I can just pardon myself, that's getting very close to what? Acknowledging the fact that one may, in fact, have broken the law and is going to try to escape responsibility by pardoning oneself out of it. I'm not sure that's the direction they really want to go, but that's where they're headed.
I think a lot of this pardoning talk is also a signal to the president, to his allies, that if they break the law on his behalf or lie to investigators, which is a crime, he'll pardon them. It's him getting in front of whatever machinery he needs to keep himself from being impeached or indicted.
And that is a possibility. But there's something else interesting, though. If he decides to pardon all these individuals, it has a different implication. Imagine, for example, that John Williams is a prosecutor and he's prosecuting David Schultz for violating some law. And you want me to testify? And I say, no, I plead my Fifth Amendment rights, which I'm entitled to do so. Well, you as a prosecutor could say, well, heck, I am going to give you immunity from prosecution, and when that happens, I can no longer assert my Fifth Amendment rights and I have to testify. If Trump starts to now issue broad pardons to individuals, that's effectively the same thing, which means at that point, they would be what? Not able to claim Fifth Amendment and potentially would be required to testify.
Right, they can't incriminate themselves because the president's already pardoned them, so their obligation would then fall back onto having to testify and tell the truth.
Exactly, and who knows what the truth is going to reveal. Now, I actually think the worst thing that can happen to Donald Trump right now is if, let's say, we're just going to, don't anybody read anything to what I'm saying here on one level, but let us say Mueller has concluded that, in fact, Trump has broken the law. That if Mueller were smart, and I think he might do this, he might say, well, the precedent from back with Nixon was that the president can't be indicted. He's just an unindicted co-conspirator in whatever it may be. Think about how bad that is for the president of the United States. He can't issue a pardon because, well, he's not been indicted. He can't have himself, acquitted in a criminal proceeding because there is no proceeding here. I think that becomes the worst possible scenario for Mueller in terms of labeling the president unindicted co-conspirator.
Well, I've been wondering about the timing. I've been wondering about the timing of this, Dave Schultz. Dave Schultz is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Minnesota and has been invited, by the way, to South Korea to talk to them about our constitution and their constitution. We'll get to that in just a couple of seconds. But I've been wondering about the timing of all of this, Dave. That is, the president doesn't have anything to pardon himself for right now. If something happened that would cause him to no longer be president, then he loses the power to pardon himself. Could he proactively, preemptively pardon himself? I'm just wondering, like, how would the chips fall in order for him to actually execute that? Because if you're found guilty of a crime or if you're thrown out of office, you lose the power of the pardon, and so then it's too late. So talk to me about that. Dave Schultz is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Minnesota. We're talking to him about the president's ability to pardon himself. The timing is critical, isn't it, Dave? I mean, you can't pardon yourself if you haven't committed a crime, and if you've committed a crime, you might be thrown out of office and lose the power to pardon yourself. So how would something that work?
Well, yes and no. First off, we're still assuming the president can pardon himself. And let's just say, for the sake of argument, he can pardon
Which,
himself.
Which, by the way, you say he cannot, but keep going.
He cannot do it. Okay. We know from back when Ford pardoned Nixon back in 1974, he did that before Nixon was ever charged with a crime, and the courts upheld that. So you could do an anticipatory pardon. I'll use that phrase. You can kind of anticipate that and do that. The second thing to keep in mind here is the Constitution's clear that the president can't use the pardoning power to escape impeachment. So that, let's say, Congress is moving towards an impeachment proceeding, and the president says, well, I'm going to pardon myself. Can't do that. I think your introduction was great when you said that the impeachment process was a political process. I think that captures it really well here. So we know that the pardon couldn't be used for impeachment, and clearly once the president is, let us say, no longer president, couldn't impeach himself either. I mean, couldn't pardon himself.
Pardon himself, yeah. It's 2:28. I just got a few seconds left. Why are you going to go to South Korea?
It's the 70th anniversary of their constitution, and the National Assembly, which is the equivalent of our Congress, asked me to come out and give a talk about the U.S. Constitution and some of the parallels between it and the South Korean Constitution, and then also a second conference they asked me to come to talk about election law in the United States. And the side trip will be, assuming nothing goes crazy, we're going to go up to the DMZ.
I wonder if we lose some of our authority on the subject of free and fair elections in the world when, A, we've been hacked, and, B, we just had the sort of turmoil and the sort of looking around the law that we're talking about. Are we no longer the beacon of light on elections in the world, or are we still?
We've lost a lot of credibility internationally, although we are still looked at for a variety of reasons for help. But it's much more ambiguous than it used to be.
That's a shame. So when are you going over to South Korea?
Is on July 10th, and then it's a very quick trip. It's only for 6 days. I'll barely be over my jet lag, but it might be a fun conversation to have because it'll be about a month after the supposed, you know, Trump conference, and granted, Trump-North Korean conference or summit. I know that's taking place in Singapore,
yeah.
But I'm going to be in the capital. I'm going to be talking to people who are in the South Korean government. I might learn something interesting.
Just before, during, or after, come on our show again, Dave.
Love to do so.
By the way, your book, Presidential Swing States, is in its second printing, and it's a book about the 10 states that matter in a presidential election. And you've got a book coming out about Scalia, too, correct?
Correct, correct. Several of us are assessing the legacy that Antonin Scalia had on the Supreme Court for 30 years. And so both those books are literally due out from the printer in the next, I would say, 6 weeks.
By the way, do I remember correctly, 10 states?
It's now up to 12. We added to that Michigan and Pennsylvania.
All right. This book about presidential swing states is called Presidential Swing States, and it's by Dave Schultz. Dave, stay busy, stay well, and let's visit again down the road.
Great. Talk to you soon.
Steve, you've heard about LitFest, right?
Yes.
Do you make appearances at that? Have you before?
I never have. No.
All of the, there you were as the principal video editor, reviewer for...
Well, really a big deal, a national figure when it comes to literature.
Well, you kind of have been,
yeah.
And you're well-read. I think you would be perfect at that. Eric Zorn, Mary Schmeek, all of our friends at the Tribune, a lot of them do that sort of thing. I would think you would be a good one to do one of those author interviews or talks.
Thank you, but I think it came close a couple years ago and it fell through.
Robert Kersen's in our studio right now. His latest book is Rocket Men.
Well, I'd want to interview Robert Kersen if I could.
I know. Well, he's sitting right here. Let's do that. Robert, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
We read Crashing Through. We read Shadow Divers. Now Rocket Men is your telling of the story of Apollo 8. You're going to be at LitFest too, right?
That's right, on Sunday.
Are you giving a self-talk or is somebody interviewing you on stage?
I'm going to be interviewed by the legendary Rick Kogan.
Oh, that'll be great. I'll preview you for it right now. We'll start at the Billy Goat.
Spot on.
What inspired you to write about Apollo 8? I think when people think about America's manned space flights, they think about Gemini, Mercury, they think about Apollo 13. How did Apollo 8 appear on your radar?
It was a totally happy accident. I was at the Museum of Science and Industry showing friends the U-505, the U-boat, which is a perfect match for the one I wrote about in my first book, Shadow Divers, which tells the story of a lost German U-boat in New Jersey waters. And as I was wandering out, you could get lost very easily in the Museum of Science and Industry. And I took a left instead of a right and found myself in the Henry Crown Space Center. And there is this space capsule that looks at once to have come from the past and the future. And I look at the placard and it says, this is Apollo 8, man's first journey to the moon. And I knew nothing about it. And I like space. I knew about Apollo 11, which is the first landing, and Apollo 13, in which an explosion in an oxygen tank makes a near tragedy for the crew. But I knew nothing about man's first journey away from home and first arrival at a new world. I went home, I did some research, and in 15 or 20 minutes, I knew I was looking at the greatest space story ever told.
Why?
Well, part of it was because so much was done for the first time. I remember listening to an interview with Neil Armstrong when I first got home, and he spoke in near reverential tones about Apollo 8 in a way he didn't even speak about Apollo 11. And one of the points he stressed was that Apollo 8 was sent to the launch pad, conceived and put on the launch pad in 4 months, not the usual 12 to 18 months. And it was for very dramatic, fascinating reasons. But he said, you know, by the time we went on Apollo 11, so much of what we did was already proven. But when Apollo 8 went, nobody knew that any of it could really be done.
Including with the rocket work.
That's right. They're going to go on the Saturn V rocket. It's the only rocket powerful enough to carry human beings to the moon. And yet, the Saturn V had only flown twice before Apollo 8, both times unmanned. And in the second of those tests, it was a near disaster of failures.
So I know, let's put some guys on there and send them to the moon.
Not just guys, but guys with children and wives, and not just with children and wives, but at Christmas, at the end of 1968, probably one of the worst years in our country's history. So this was incredibly dramatic from the first moment it was conceived.
And they tried to be sensitive to that. That is, oh yeah, they'll be doing this at Christmas time in 1968. will that look as a political ploy? They were actually wondering if it would be conceived that way.
That's right. Chris Kraft, the master...
Perceived that way, yeah.
Yes. Chris Kraft, who was the mastermind of Mission Control and a real NASA legend, worried that it would be viewed as a political stunt. But he said it wasn't politics that dictated the Christmas flight. It was nature. And so they had to obey the laws of the universe, and that's when the launch window opened.
Yeah. But it was politics that maybe forced the issue. That is, if I understand correctly, we're in the middle of a Cold War with the Soviet Union. And we send a spaceship up, they send a spaceship up. They send a manned flight up, we send a manned flight up. They send a dog up, et cetera, et cetera. They got to the moon before we did, right?
Well, they have two flights in 1968 that go around the moon. They're both unmanned. But it looks for all the world like they are ready to send the first men around the moon. And that's a huge deal. Space is viewed as a huge military imperative. The first country that could send men into space could build space stations, put soldiers in space.
Yeah, what do you think about that? Because that was the imperative, but do you think that it was necessary for those reasons to be first in space?
I think it was a huge psychological component to that. But also, if you won the space race by delivering the first men to the moon, that's a huge argument in favor of your way of life, your brand of science, and your political structure. So it's a huge propaganda issue for both sides in this existential space race that's going on.
I don't know. In retrospect, it just seemed to me to be a little, silly's not the right word, but wrong-headed. That is, we don't have space soldiers. We aren't using satellites to deliver weapons. That it mattered politically. Maybe the national pride was at stake. But the idea that we've got to get in space first because maybe we'll control the space and therefore have a military advantage, I don't know, was that borne out? Is that true?
Well, I don't know. Once Apollo 8 proved that it could be done, and then we followed on with Apollo 11 and the subsequent Apollo flights, the space race was pretty much over, and we had won. So we don't really know how it would have played out that way. And certainly no one's ever been back since then. But it was a huge and devastating blow to the Soviet Union in terms of the argument for whose political system is right, whose scientific approach is right, and everything else. So I think it was a grave, dealt a grave damaging blow to them.
So they do it in 4 months' time?
4 months from conception to liftoff.
And that was a tough sell in Washington, wasn't it?
Very tough, because in January of 1967, not even 2 years earlier, NASA had lost three brave astronauts on the launch pad during a test for Apollo 1. That itself almost doomed the Apollo program. And to risk another three lives here could easily have ended the space program. And yet here they're going to do it, and they're going to do it faster than anyone thought humanly possible.
Were the astronauts enthusiastic?
Very much so. Frank Borman accepted the, he's the commander, he accepted the change in mission on the spot. He didn't consult his crewmates, Jim Lovell and Bill Anders. Or his wife or the other wives. He just said yes, but Borman viewed the entire space program and the mission to get men to the moon as a military one. He was there at NASA for one reason and one reason only, and that was to defeat the Soviets on the ultimate battlefield, space.
So they get the rockets built. They get the computers coded properly, et cetera, and then the ship lifts off. How does the mission go?
Well, even in the first moments, Bill Anders thinks the mission is going terribly. Despite having the ultimate world-class state-of-the-art simulators that hoped to simulate the violence of a Saturn V launch, it came nowhere close. It couldn't touch it. It was a baby
simulator. Test one, two, three. Compared.
Standby, standby.
Hey, this isn't working.
There we go. That's another studio. Keep talking. Yeah. So the shaking in the capsule was so violent, they didn't anticipate that.
They had no idea. In fact, Bill Anders believed that the rocket's fins were being shorn off by the launch tower. It was so crazy and so violent, they all lost control of their limbs. They couldn't see the instruments. The only thing Anders really detected was Borman taking his hand off the abort handle. And Borman will tell you, I would have rather died than abort in a mistake. And he means it literally. He would have rather died. So they are riding this no matter what. And it lifts off much more slowly than the other faster rockets they used in the Gemini program.
It was so heavy.
So heavy and so much power. The power of a small atomic bomb underneath them.
Huh. So it lifts off, the one stage separates, the other stage separates. Was there any concern that they would generate enough velocity to escape the Earth's gravity, or did they know that if the rockets survive, that they would be able to blast off to the moon.
Yeah, they felt very confident. They're going to go into Earth orbit for about 90 minutes to make sure everything's okay, but they have to relight the third stage engine. But they believe if that lights, they can gain enough momentum from around 17,400 miles an hour to near 25,000 miles an hour to escape Earth's gravity.
I love, too, was it Borman who was all business?
Yes.
And so they say, okay, great. So we're going to be up there. And then the PR guys go, we'll have you do a couple of TV specials right. from space. What was his reaction to that?
Well, he was flat out against it. He wanted, and by the way, their plan is to orbit 10 times around the moon. He wanted to orbit once. He thought that was enough to put a final nail in the Soviet coffin in the space race, and that's all they needed to do. But NASA really wanted to learn everything there was about making a manned lunar flight and landing. So they want them there as long as possible, and they want the cameras there because this belongs to not just the United States, it belongs to all the world. This is the first time mankind is leaving home and the first time we're arriving at our new world, our most ancient companion. And so they want it all documented. And Borman fights against it and fights against it. He loses that fight, and they tell him there will be four broadcasts, including number three, which will be heard and listened to by more people than have ever tuned in to a human voice in history.
Is that the Christmas broadcast?
That's Christmas Eve.
And how does that go?
Well, they give him these very detailed instructions about what to say. They tell him, say something appropriate, and that's it. And he laughs to this day, and he's got the best laugh you'll ever hear. And he says, can you imagine being told that today? Today, you go through 14 committees and 15 focus groups to the White House and copyright. They just left it completely to the astronauts, and there was a struggle to figure out what to do. But they finally, with the help of some really concerned friends, including one woman who came up with the right idea at about 2:30 in the morning one night, right before the flight, they came up with what they believed would be the perfect thing to say to the world, not just the country, on Christmas Eve at the end of the worst year in our country's history.
What was that?
Well, they're up there and they're showing us a tour of the moon. And you can go on YouTube right now and watch this. It's incredibly dramatic. And they're showing us this is this crater and they're passing over this mountain. And with about 2 minutes left in the broadcast, they say, we have a message to wish to the world on this Christmas Eve. And Bill Anders begins to read the first lines from the book of Genesis. In the beginning. And one after another in Mission Control, these very serious scientific men start to be reduced to tears because they know what's being read. It is an origin story, our origin story. And it speaks to so many people in the world. And it doesn't speak to just one country or just one nation or one religion. It speaks to almost everyone. And it sees us all as one people at the end of this terrible year. So Anders reads his part, and then Lovell takes over, and finally Borman. And after Borman's done, people are sobbing all over the world, and Borman wishes people a Merry Christmas on the good earth, he says. And around the world, people stream out from their homes, from schools, from buildings, from taverns, all over the world, coming outside and looking skyward, hoping to catch a glimpse of this space capsule at the moon, knowing full well they're not going to see it, but looking all the same, because no one had ever been spoken to that way at that time as one.
I was just a boy when man landed on the moon. We were living in Hawaii. Everybody remembers where they were. And I remember my dad pointing up there and saying, they're up there now. Have we had a moment of awe like the Apollo mission since then?
I don't think we've come close. I mean, if you watched the launch of Falcon Heavy a couple months ago, it was stunning. It was an incredible feat of engineering, and you saw these retro rockets land themselves back on the pad. It looked like
in unison.
It looked like a science fiction movie.
Yeah.
But Hollywood could never create effects like the real thing, like we saw there. And yet, there's no sense that we're engaged in an existential battle and doing something that's never been done before, and that we've yearned to do for millennia since mankind walked the earth for the first time. So the stakes I don't think they'll ever be equaled quite the same way again.
The book is called Rocket Men, Robert Curson's latest New York Times bestseller. You read Crashing Through, and if you haven't, you have to go back and read that too. You've written how many books?
This is my fourth.
Yeah, I know. It seems to, I thought it was four.
Yeah.
It would seem to me like there would be more, like maybe 50 or something like that. The bane of your existence must be finding those stories.
It's the scariest thing. That's what keeps a nonfiction writer up at night. And when you have a story like Apollo 8 and Rocket Men, which I consider, you know, one of the great stories in our country's history, it's hard to find one worthy as a successor.
And do people come up to you at cocktail parties and go, I got one. Tell the story about, and then it's not a good story.
All the time. And they really do give me good stories. They're good magazine stories usually. But
yeah, right. You need 350 pages,
right.
Don't you?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, he's got one here, Rocket Men. He'll be at LitFest. What day are you going to be there, Dion?
On Sunday.
Sunday.
I can't recall the time, but it's online.
Google litfest.org and check that out. Now, we got to talk about this tomorrow. Kevin's one of our many White Sox experts here. And Kevin Powell, the MLB draft is tonight, and the mm-hmm. White Sox go number 4, right?
Correct, yeah. I think there's real reason to be excited. You've seen guys that go in the top 5, top 3 in that area can make immediate impact sometimes. So for a team that's rebuilding, you lose a lot of games, and you see this in pretty much every sport, sometimes almost on purpose, whether they admit it or not, to get these picks. So you get excited about it. You want them to land. You want them to get a guy who can, you know, produce down
the road. Well, is there any worry? Because I know in some drafts, in some sports, you pick the wrong guy and you're screwed. You know, the NBA draft is an example of that.
Right.
Is there any worry that there's a wrong pick out there for the White Sox?
Well, I think you don't feel it as much as in other sports. You know, if you have an NFL pick and you have the top overall pick, you feel that, right? Because
yeah.
That's an immediate impact. You can point
doesn't
to that
happen
moment.
In baseball, though.
Well,
they're
baseball,
go to the
you
minors.
Have such a huge pool of players, but, you know, in 2 or 3 years, you may look back and be like, man, you missed out on a top 5 pick. So, of course, it'll sting a little bit, but I don't think it sticks out as much as an NBA or an NFL.
They're going to take a pitcher again?
I think it's going to be Singer from Florida or Madrigal, the infielder from Oregon State. The Singer's the pitcher, Madrigal's the infielder. It just sort of depends on who's there.
I'm amazed that you could play.
He's 5'7".
At 5'7".
Well, look at Jose Altuve. He won the MVP last year.
I know it's
a rarity, but I think they're going to go best available. I do.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's catch up on this tomorrow.
Definitely.
It's a minute away from 3 o'clock. Ro Khan and Anna DeVlantis are in the studio. Hi, campers.
Hello.
Hi there, John.
What's the
Happy Monday.
Get those headphones on. Microphones ready.
Set up, ready for business.
Now, what are you guys going to do?
I don't even know where to begin. You know, there are mornings where you wake up and you look at your phone, and then I just wanted to pull the covers back over my head.
Which tweet this time?
Yeah, I think it was the main one. I think it's the one that says basically I could shoot Comey in the head or Mueller in the head in the middle of the street and you can't do nothing to me.
Yeah, right.
Come get me, coppers.
Yeah.
I don't really get, even if it is true, and it's, you know, debatable, the Supreme Court will eventually have to decide this. I fear, unfortunately, now it may be the time for them to have to decide it. But it just, why do you have to say it?
This isn't Giuliani's stripe, but I would have said no comment when they asked him, does the president have the ability to pardon himself?
Right.
I would just say, you know what, we'll cross that bridge if we get there, and we're not going to get there. Next question.
It's a little bit of the way he, I mean, depending on the interview you saw with Giuliani yesterday, but when the president says it, I mean, the president himself says, you know, it's absolutely, I have absolute pardon power, I can pardon myself if I want to.
Yeah.
I mean,
you know what, I don't understand.
How does it make anybody feel safe?
And Giuliani also over the weekend said, all right, 5 or 6 questions. We need to know what the points are. It has to be brief if he ever sits down with Mueller. I didn't know that, you know, when they have the white bulb and you're sitting there in the interrogation room and they're interrogating you, you get to dictate the terms. You get to say, all right, coppers, I'm only going to ask 5 questions and I need them cleared in advance.
This is a strategy. It's obviously the tactics within the strategy are to keep saying just sort of cut away at this notion that Mueller has any power here, which is to say that he's unconstitutional. That's the first thing that they're saying, which is not true. Then that Mueller's investigation is unconstitutional. Then to say it doesn't matter what he comes up with because I can always pardon myself.
Yeah.
So, and I don't have to, and I'm never going to meet a subpoena. So, you know, if you do want to talk to me, here are my rules.
What's a perjury trap?
A perjury trap is to set him up into something that they know is already a lie and get him to lie about it, which would be about something unrelated potentially to Russia or even about Russia. Listen, if they had said what they were saying the whole time, there's one problem with this. And I would just like just even the most diehard supporters of the president just to acknowledge this. They told us forever there were no meetings with the Russians. Then it came out that there were a dozen meetings with Russians, including Don Jr. and Jared Kushner and Paul Manafort meeting with the Russians, and that was about sanctions at Trump Tower. And that was before, that was in June of the election year. I mean, at least just say, okay, We misremembered. We didn't want. We didn't. We thought it would be too much. We're sorry. We made a mistake. And that's what they're saying now. We misremembered this stuff. That's the reason that people are looking at this. This is not like there's nothing to this. There's obviously something to this. And then the president, I never wrote that memo. The president never wrote that memo. Then it turns out, yeah, he wrote the memo that did changing the story behind
it. I was stunned by that revelation this weekend. The president authored that.
We keep learning things.
Well, you're right. And it's like Sarah Sanders was asked about that in her afternoon briefing today. And she had told them the exact opposite, that the president did and then didn't. And they asked, why did you change your story on that? And there aren't any real answers.
Yeah.
So, I mean, changing stories, I mean, even if you are sort of on the fence about Donald Trump, this kind of takes you over a little bit to the side of, I don't know how safe I feel because the story keeps changing, and now he says he has absolute authority. Yeah. And I don't care what you think about Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. I got my own thoughts about Hillary and Bill today. I think that they need to go get their own island and move to it and leave the continental United States.
I wouldn't have done that Today Show interview.
No. But it was about the book, and then it just swiftly turned in a different direction.
Did he not think that was going to happen?
Moronic movement. We'll talk about that, too.
Yeah. All right.
But this is one of those moments. I mean, come on. This, as much as they thought, well, Barack Obama's an imperial president, he never said this. Right? You can't catch me, coppers. Oh, man.
He's here. Roll Karn and Adam.